Are we good to go?
I believe we're recording. So we're now live. It's Wednesday, November the 25th. Here on the Pacific West Coast, it's 32 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning, and that's the year 2015. And I'm talking to Sherry Jennings. Sherry, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, the title, of course, is The Worthy Organization and Exploring the Worthy Organization. And so in preparation for this session, I went out and looked at some of the myths about nonprofits, and one of them is that they have lots of resources and they're big. And of course, I think people think of the Red Cross, the American Red Cross, and some of those other large nonprofits, and think, well, they have plenty of resources. But in fact, most of them have budgets under $1 million and are very small in terms of not having a lot of, and they're struggling. They don't have a lot of resources. They don't have a lot of staff. There are also a couple of associated myths, which are that a nonprofit can't make a profit, which is completely wrong. And the other myth is that that administrative costs ought to be kept low. So I think in this over the this session, just exploring some of those things, and one of the reasons that you wrote most of the essays in the word that are up here in the Worthy Organization. You want to hold it up again?
Oh,
Yeah. One of the reasons that
this
we.
is the book that Sherry and I wrote. By the way, what I'm holding up, just to be clear, and in the interest of full honesty here, this thing I'm holding up is a prop. This is not the actual book. If you want to see the book, you have to go and find it online, which you can, and it exists only in the cloud. It's an ebook.
And you don't have to buy it if you don't really want. You can just peruse the topics and look at what's there. But most of what's in the Worthy Organization are essays and thoughts and advice about how to take a small nonprofit, which most are, and to make it a professional organization that can put its best foot forward and be good stewards and caretakers of the resources that it has. And that's some of what a lot of smaller organizations struggle with is how to take good care of several resources that are available to them, not the least of which is volunteers. But another myth about nonprofits is that all the work is done by volunteers, but it's simply not true. If you want to have great programs, you've got to have great staff, and you've got to pay those staff. That you need people who are consistently there and able to manage and recruit the volunteers and to help make sure the volunteers are engaged and involved. So there are a lot of, I think, a lot of myths surrounding a nonprofit organization, and many of them are struggling to understand how to become worthy of attracting the resources that they need. And Robert, you've got a great answer for that in terms of you can attract what you need. Go on.
Well, one of the things I find with a lot of organizations is, for one reason or another, they feel they don't have all the money they need to do whatever they want to do. And a very tragic thing happens not infrequently, and you've probably seen this as well, where an organization has had a vision that's attracted a grant. And for several years, the money has been flowing in, and everybody is really happy about how the grant is working. And then, for some reason, the granting agency changes its mind, and most granting agencies will not treat you as an employee. Eventually, the grant dries up and the money goes away. And the people are terrified. They have had a part-time executive director, perhaps, or even a full-time executive director. They've been funded, everything's been going well, the board has been deciding on all the wonderful things the organization is going to be doing, and then the rug is pulled out from under them. And what I find is the immediate thing they say is, we must cut our cloth to fit. And so what they do is they cut back on everything. And because they have cut back, the next thing that happens is the people who have supported them don't love them as much because they're not doing all the things that they were doing. They've lost track of what they were set up for. And very often when somebody like you or I come along, we say, at one point you didn't have the grant. Is your organization still necessary? Is it still vital? Does the community need what you have? Remember, there was a time when you didn't have the grant, and yet your organization arose out of the community to meet a need. Is the need still there? And very often, the board hasn't been thinking about their need. They haven't articulated it. They haven't done anything about it. They have assumed that they are necessary. Well, isn't it obvious that we're doing good work? Well, no, you're the board, you're the leadership, you need to think about it. And what I usually do is say, go back to your vision, see why you're necessary. And when you can articulate it to yourselves, can you then explain it to other people? And I do believe that if an organization is truly necessary in a community, the resources can be found, but you need to understand that vision first. And I know that when I talk to people about vision, they get this wonderful, what's our vision? And they begin to look somewhere beyond the horizon and spout poetry. And I say, no. You exist for a real purpose in this community. You are transforming the community in a beneficial way. Can you tell me exactly what is the benefit you're providing? Can you tell me why you're providing it? And can we explain it in a manner that we can explain it to a lot of other people? And frankly, when you begin to go down that route, not only can you find what's necessary, but you can find a lot of new supporters. In a sense, a loss of funding might be an opportunity to rediscover what your organization is really all about and strengthen it to a point where it never existed before because you're being more intentional.
You know, and on a similar note, Robert, the other thing that I found about helping the board go through a clear articulation of what it is they're about, their organization is about, it also takes away the fear of the board members from going out there and being ambassadors for the organization, because now they've got that 30-second elevator speech or whatever you want to call it, but that way of expressing and articulating what it is this organization is for. And you don't have to ask people for money. If you're simply able to go out and talk with people about what it is the organization exists for, you're able to attract people who are interested in that and who want to support it and who will probably ask you, how can I write a check? What can I do? How can I help? And those are the things that you begin to attract like-minded people who are interested in what you have carved out as what it is you feel like you can actually transform within your community and that you've set yourselves to it to do it. And you know, when you talk about vision, Robert, and you said, well, you know, people go way out there and often they're reaching for something that's not doable. It's not something they'll ever see done in their lifetime. And you want to try to create something in which you can track progress and say, look at what we're changing and look at how we're able to change it. I'll use a big organization as an example, but it's one of those big audacious goals that's actually probably going to be doable in our lifetime, and that's end polio. Something very simple, but ending polio globally is something that we'll likely see in our lifetime. Now, a small organization isn't going to be able to have an audacious goal like that, but they can certainly look at what the needs are in their community and say, what does the community expect from us? What is it that we are needing to do? And I'll give you an example of another smaller organization that originally set out to provide homes and housing for at-risk moms, single moms leaving abusive situations, a place for them to land, and providing nice, good housing that honored the people and made them feel like they were warm and welcome. And that was their original niche, was to build that. Well, now that they've been involved with building those that housing for the last 25 years, the board said, well, wait a minute. Is this really what the community wants and needs from us still? Or should we begin to assess what the community believes that we ought to be doing? And we have a particular niche in what it is that we do. And should we now reevaluate that? And so one of the boards I'm working with is in the process of doing that. And they've also hired a new executive director. And that new executive director said, wow, that's really powerful to be able to say, you know, what is it the community wants from us? But it's more than want, as you point out, Robert. It's about what does a community need to have happen.
There's a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, you mentioned elevator speeches. And what I found about elevator speeches is you can construct them. You can hold sessions with your friends and come up with the elevator speech. But the place where you sharpen it is when you deliver it, when you begin to get some feedback from people. And you can tell the folks that have had a well-honed elevator speech, but you can't hone it around the board table. You've got to do it in the elevators and in other people's offices. You've got to watch their eyes and see how they're reacting to you and modify it until you get it right. Now, the other thing that you talked about was organizations that are there in the community to make some kind of a difference. And I find that a lot of not-for-profits are willing to do something because an issue exists in the community. And this is even a bigger topic. We'll get around to talking about this. Maybe we can make a whole program out of this one. But what they do is tell you how effective they are at helping to alleviate some aspect of the problem. And this gets back to our vision statement. And I say, why are you just doing some things about the problem? Why don't you solve the problem? Why don't you end it? That polio campaign that Rotary is about to complete after many, many years is marvelous. Not can we help all the people around the world who have polio? Can we reduce it? It's can we end polio for all times? Can we bring this time of great affliction to an end? And one of the aspects of just helping is that if an organization is in the community, and I mean maybe just in your town or your city or worldwide, it doesn't matter, but if it's in the community and all it's doing is helping, I point out that there might be an actual negative effect of that, because the community sees your organization as being accountable for coping with this problem. If all you're willing to do is help, the problem isn't going to go away. And because you're there and you've raised your hand and said, we are the ones who are dealing with this issue, I believe you're standing in the way of another organization arising and saying, we will attend to this issue and we will end it.
That's really powerful, Robert. And I just learned something about Rotary that I did not know. And that is, they were involved in that helping business early on. They started Easter Seals, which was a campaign to help crippled children. And finally, it dawned on them, they went, duh, why don't we just end the scourge that causes children to be crippled to begin with? And, you know, so that's a great example of how you can get in your own way by helping. And you can get and you're not thinking about, you know, what can we do to prevent this thing from occurring to begin with.
I see this all the time because I, you know, my early days of volunteering, I was on organizations that were very proud of a lot of things that they were doing, but I really like the idea that an organization can have a bigger vision. And why not? You don't need to be able to solve the problem tomorrow. What you need to do is see a legitimate path to solving the problem. And you don't need to do all of it yourself. You may partner with other organizations. We have talked about Rotary, and both of us certainly know about Rotary. It's partnered with the World Health Organization and with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They've brought in lots of other resources, but those resources were attracted to something that that organization started. In fact, one of the things I've heard people in Rotary complain about is, Rotary was the one that got this started. How come all we hear about is Bill and Melinda Gates and the World Health Organization? It's Rotary that did this. And it doesn't matter.
Right.
Because you're there to solve a real need.
That's right. And, you know, you raise a really good point there. You know, so many nonprofit organizations, they get into their little silos of feeling like they're all alone against the world and they're competing against everybody else to get money and attract resources. And you know, what they are not doing is they're not leveraging what's available to them. And that, you know, and I look in my own community and I'm looking at the programs that are out there to affect at-risk youth and homeless youth. And they're all operating in their own little zones, and they're all competing for the same dollars from the same pocketbooks, and they're not really looking to operate together, except for one that I'm now, that I've been working with for a while, has said, wait a minute, our organization and this other organization essentially are doing the same thing. Why should we be competing with each other? Why shouldn't we leverage each other? And in fact, now it's gotten down to a point where they're looking at merging the two organizations to become a stronger single organization. So, I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities that can occur if you begin to look outside your own, you know, you get hunkered down thinking, oh, we, you know, poor us, we're a poor little nonprofit. We don't have enough to do what we need to do, and we're just struggling. You know, you don't have to. You just don't have to.
In fact, one of the things we teach, and I know you do this, is boards are always busy looking into their organization.
Yes.
Part of looking out is not just at the rest of the community, but also making the effort to find out who else is serving the same community, and to be able to take the effort as a board, as individual board members, and collectively as a board to be in touch with those other organizations, to work together with them, and to find out how solving the community's problems can be done in a more collective and collaborative manner.
Yeah, it's really powerful. It was funny, I mentioned to a board of directors recently, I said, you know, as a board member, one of the things that you might want to do is, instead of having a board meeting once, you know, 1 month, why don't you go to a board meeting of another organization that's on a similar trajectory and just, you know, call up and say, would it be okay if I sat in? Our organizations have similar, you know, callings in the community, a similar mission. Just like to learn more about yours. And the light bulbs went on all around the room for the board, and they were saying, we need to do that, don't we? Yeah. Yeah, you do. because it unless you really are out there, and you know, one of the things that I have a bit of a problem with are the SWOT analyses. And I'll tell you why I have a problem with the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, is because of just what you said, Robert, is that they tend to be focused internally. And they're not focused externally about looking outside your organization and what's happening outside it. And in fact, if I have somebody call me and say, oh, our board's going to have a retreat on Saturday, would you come and facilitate it for us? I'll say no, because I know that between now and Saturday is not enough time for them to gather the information and the intelligence that they need to be able to think outside of their own organization. And you know, you've got to do the preparation prior to that. And if they're not willing to do the preparation and to think in that way, I won't do it.
Well, tell me, you mentioned you don't like SWAT, and most people who do that would say the opportunities and threats aspect is looking out. Is it the negative aspect of the opportunities and threats that worry you? Tell me what the concern is there.
What I found typically is that it's really easy for people to come up with lists of weaknesses and threats, while the opportunities and things that are strengths tend to be a much shorter list. And in fact, once they start working on the weaknesses and threats, it's so easy to come up with a long list of those. And then it's very difficult for them to become focused on what they have that's a positive place to begin to build from. And boy, I got to tell you that if you start with the strengths, however you do it, but you start thinking about what your strengths are, what are you good at? And then you go out and you do an external look at what other organizations are doing, where else are things that are occurring, where are there overlaps, where are there gaps? Are you truly focused on the need that you were as an organization were set out to do, or are you kind of encroaching on what everybody else is doing? And part of it is because of that granting thing. If you're always chasing grants, you're going to find that you have mission creep, and you're starting to become everything to everybody all the time, and you're not focused on what your true strength is and what your organization is best set up to do. And that concept came from Good to Great, a book that Jim Collins wrote many years ago. But when he looked at organizations who were tremendously successful, and these are for-profit organizations, he found out that they focused on their central core of what it was they were best in the world at. And so many nonprofits lose track of that because they're constantly chasing grant money. And all those grants have strings attached, and they all have their own things that they want you to do. So rather than being very judicious about what grants you're going to go after and what funding resources you're going to go after, people are often looking just for any kind of money anywhere, but it tends to take them off their course. So yeah, it's when you start focusing on the negative, the list gets longer and longer and longer. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough people. We don't have enough time. We don't have, the last time we did a fundraiser, we didn't raise enough money. And, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in that. But if you get focused on what is it you're really, really good at, and what are the things that bring life to your organization and make it stand apart from every other organization out there, you begin to shine a light on the possibilities. And I'm very big into positive psychology and appreciative inquiry. And beginning with the things that you're best at, beginning with the things that you can do well, it gives you a platform in the middle of the swamp. So when the swamp is drained and you're up to your proverbial rear end in alligators, you've got a place to climb up onto.
Yes.
And you know that you can build from there. So I'm all about the building piece and less about the tearing down piece. Let's not tear ourselves down.
So you're not concerned about people being blindsided by things going on in the environment?
Mm-mm. 'Cause they're going to be there anyway. But if you have resilience that you've built in by developing your strengths and understanding what they are, resilience is key. You can weather anything as long as you've got that solid place from which you can always go back to and build from. I mean, threats and yeah, we all have weaknesses. We're people, you know, we're human beings. And even a collection of human beings in an organization, we all have weaknesses. But that's why we have other human beings, because they're good at doing stuff we're not good at doing. So unless you're able to identify within yourself and identify for your own organization what it is you're best at, and recognizing what other organizations are best at, and saying, well, how can we work together? How can we leverage that? How can we begin to help other people understand what we're really good at so they can begin to understand what we can do? Until you're able to talk about that, you're going to constantly be, and I hear this all the time from board members and staff, well, we just don't have enough money to do what we need to do. That's not a place to begin.
Well, one of the things I know from working with you is your use of appreciative inquiry. And I certainly have seen how when a board, when a group of people, in the case I'm thinking of, a board, begins to look at what they love about their organization, what they love about their work in the organization, what they really care about, they begin to get energized. So I know you use the techniques of appreciative inquiry, and it's actually fun to see how you use it so that right at the outset, when you begin to work with the people, even before you begin to get down to working with the problems and working with the issues, people are really juiced about their organization. They're juiced about what they can accomplish. They can juice. They're juiced about themselves. And I've seen you do that, Sherry.
Yeah.
You want to tell me a little bit about how that happens?
Yeah. Because I'm one of those kind of people that doesn't, that I'm a researcher. I'm a scientist first and foremost, and I believe it's most important to hear from individuals on a board. So if you're working with a board of directors, oftentimes you'll have a group of people who, there are some who are very talkative, who are very articulate, who are able to express themselves quite well. There are others who are quiet, who are listeners, who don't tend to express themselves often. And I found that by doing one-on-one appreciative inquiry sessions with each individual, number one, their voices are heard, and that's really powerful. And number two, they're now beginning to explore for themselves, hey, you know, I have a lot that I can bring to this. I have a lot that I can begin to build on and to help others build on within this organization. And oh, by the way, you know, a lot of the things that make me happy and that give me a sense of fulfillment are connected to what I'm doing in this organization. You know, that's why I started here to begin with. So often my first question is, what attracted you to this organization? You know, and what gives it life for you? And once people begin to think of it less in terms of, well, what does everybody else think, which can start to begin to be groupthink in a way. Instead of thinking that way, they're thinking about, wow, I have a lot to contribute. I have a lot I can do here. And they begin to think about it in a different way. So it, for me, it's very powerful. It's worth the time to invest up front with people individually. And then when they come together, I'm able to say, I've talked to each of you individually, and these are the common themes that I heard from all of you. And it's very powerful for them to understand that they're in a group of like-minded folks who want the same things to happen. It may sound like that should be intuitive, but it isn't. It isn't, because often there's, you know, people are invited to a board because they have resources or connections or, you know, and they've never really had the time to explore, what's our culture? What do we have in common? What is it we want to accomplish together? And they've never had that done that in an explicit, planned way. And I think that's essential.
One of the things that comes up again and again is that comment. I'm getting it. I don't know why. That comment that says, isn't it obvious? And very often things aren't obvious at all. By the way, we've been going for half an hour. We didn't invite anybody to join us today. We've been exploring Blab, and I wonder, I think if we were going to be doing this on a regular basis, this is when we probably would say, we've talked a little bit, we've talked about some subjects that are important to us, and then see what the other folks who are paying attention to us would like to contribute to what we're doing. And I'm wondering if we want to continue this today, or if we want to say we've had our first experiment with this and see what we have and do a little bit of a retrospective when we look at the recording.
Yes, I want to thank the two people who joined us today because this was our experiment. We have not used Flab before, and we wanted to understand more about how it looked and how it worked. So we didn't know where this was going, but we're happy that you came with us on our first journey into Blab, so thank you.
In that case, shall we wind it up?
Let's wind it up.
Now, there is no exit button here. I think that all we do is go away, and I suspect that when I go away, the recording will end. I think that's all I need to do. So what I'm going to do is close the window.
Okay.
And Jerry, thank you very much for joining
thank
me today.
You.
And we'll. I think we're going to do this weekly, are we not?
Yes, once a week.
So we'll be back next Wednesday at 8:30 Pacific Standard Time. Thank you very much for listening.